Good afternoon. This is Mike Galvin. I'm Public Affairs Officer for the USGS. Thank you for joining us. I apologize for those of you who were tricked by our the time listed on some advisories. We had a little confusion about Arizona time and Eastern time, but you are in the correct place at the right time now. Today we are having, we're going to talk for a little bit about some information that some photographs that we brought out of the canyon as a in the follow-up to the high flow experiment that we began about a month or 6 weeks ago. The information that we're going to be talking about today is available to you for download at usgs.gov. It's already up there and you can access it at any time. Today, on the phone, we will have two of our scientists talking about these photographs and some of their preliminary observations in the canyon. And they are Andrea Alpine, who is director of USGS's Southwest Biological Science Center, and Ted Mellis, who's deputy chief of the USGS Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center. They will be making some statements, and then we will, during which your phone lines are muted, as soon as they have finished, we'll unmute you so you can ask questions. Now, please note that we are recording this for use on our website as a podcast, and you'll be able to get recordings later, but be aware that you're being recorded. After Andrea and Ted make their statements, I'll ask you to ask your questions. Please be patient with each other. It's hard to manage on a conference call like this. And please, reporters asking a question, if you would identify yourself and the media outlet you work for. We'll take questions for a while, and then Jennifer will have some final information for you. So if Andrea is on the line, I will turn it over to her.
Thanks, Mike. Yes, I'm here. Good morning or afternoon, whatever your pleasure is. And I'm very happy that all of you could join us today. We have some exciting preliminary observations that we wanted to share with you from this experiment. Just to give you a little background before we get into these preliminary observations, this is part, what we work on here is part of an adaptive management program that's under the Secretary of the Interior. This is the, I work in the domain of the science part of that program, and we have a process where we work with 25 stakeholders. Some of them are on the call today. This is the adaptive management program. These folks include federal agencies and all the folks who are involved in managing these valuable resources, and the stakeholders involved in the process also. So that group gets together many times a year and has been working for at least a decade, trying to figure out the very best ways to manage the dam for its multiple purposes. Our role in that is to conduct the science, and the science that these managers help define. They define the questions that they need answers to, and we design the experiments to help them answer that. And this experiment is called the High Flow Experiment. It was begun, this particular one, we've done them twice before in 1996 and in 2004. And in this particular experiment, the beginning of the experiment was that we released approximately 41,000 cubic feet per second of water. You probably all got to see the Secretary open those gates of the dam, and we ran that for 60 hours. This, for us, this really is the beginning of the experiment because that was just the start. The next part, for the next year or two, we're going to be monitoring all the effects of that flow on various resources throughout the canyon. And so now we're going to operate that dam under its normal operating conditions, and we'll watch to see what's happened. We've been measuring things all the way from sandbars, creations, or erosions, to the effects on aquatic habitats, on vegetation, on the various fish that exist in this river, and we'll be doing that for the next, as I said, 18 to 24 months. What we wanted to share with you today is brought them out of the canyon. We have some cameras at various locations throughout the camera where we take time-lapse photography. And during this, during the high flow, we had these cameras shooting every day, a number of times a day, so that we could actually watch this water rise during the high flow event. And then as it was receding, we could see whether we did create bars in certain locations and their associated backwater habitats, another critical resource that we're studying. And then you'll be able to see them on those two ones that you'll see. That they've given you the address, I think, to find them. We've done them for two places, just to give you a taste of what we're seeing. At River Mile 3, you can go onto our websites and you'll see where these locations are along the corridor. River Mile 3 was one of the areas where we actually eroded beaches during this high flow event. This is in the upper Marble Canyon. And in River Mile 45, as you go through those time lapse, you can see where a beach was actually created, and where, even in this picture, I think you can see some of the recreational uses of that beach. So this is the, we wanted to give you all a snapshot to get you some of the initial observations that we have. We are a ways from being able to tell you whether this experiment was a success or not, but we wanted to keep people informed as we do our analysis. I think that gives you a pretty good background of this, and I think, Mike, we're ready for questions if folks have them.
Okay, do we have questions? And please introduce yourself when you ask. Okay, we think we have unmuted everyone. Would somebody like to ask a question to see if we're right?
I have a question. This is Alexa, NBC in Burbank. Hello?
Alexa?
Yes, hi. Can you just confirm, you released approximately 41,000 cubic feet, and you ran for 60 hours. What was that number?
Andrea?
Yes, that's correct. 41,000 cubic feet per second. I just got a note that says it's 41,500 cubic feet per second. Your reclamation will be probably our best bet to get the exact numbers, and then we ran it for 60 hours.
Okay, thank you.
This is Amanda Myers at the Associated Press. Andrea, you were talking about at the one point you had erosion, at the other point a beach was created. Is there any way to say what the overall picture is along the 277 miles?
That's what we're, as we speak, next to me, Dr. Mellis has a lot of photographs that he's matching right now. What we brought out of the canyon were coming up from mile 88, 1 through 88. The folks are out on the trip now. I expect to get most of that back by the middle of April. So I think we'll have a better answer to that question. The simple answer is I can't tell you yet. The longer answer is that I hope by the end of April we'll have enough photographs on the web that you can get a better picture of that whole canyon. But I do have to say that it's going to take us a while to really answer one of the fundamental questions. And the fundamental question is really, where did we create beaches and where did we lose them? How big were those beaches? What we're trying to do is do what we call the mass balance. It's basically saying is we had X amount of sediment to start with. Now, where did it go? Is it in beaches? Is it still in the sediment bottom, in the bottom of that river? Or has it moved downstream? And we're going to get that out as fast as we can, but that will take us some time.
Yeah, hi. Christy Ashwanden here with High Country News. I have a question about sediment. What are sediment goals for the Grand Canyon National Park, and how does this project fit in with that?
Well, I'm not the best person to answer the question for the Park Service on what the sediment goals are. What I'd say is, for the adaptive management program, the question really is that they're asking us to investigate is there a flow-only option, meaning can you operate the dam without adding additional sediment, for instance, by a bypass tube or some other kind of way that you would add to the sediment? Is there a flow-only option where you could maintain and create beaches? And that's what we're studying. And that's exactly how many and where you need them are still parts of the investigation and still parts of the work that the managers, including the Park Service, will help us define and will help the group define so that we can best manage this resource to keep those beaches around for a long, long time.
Hi, this is Cindy Cole with the Arizona Daily Sun. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So I'm wondering, after the last flow, the most recent, how long did it take for those beaches to erode, and how long is whatever has been built here expected to last?
I'm going to pass that to my sediment expert, Ted Mellis.
Yes, Cindy, that's a good question. Sandbars are inherently unstable. Of course, they're not consolidated. They're basically piles of sand as they exist along the river. They're subject to reworking by any operation from the dam that comes after they're built. And what we've seen from our long-term monitoring data set is that higher the daily operations go and the more they tend to reach higher peaks under fluctuating flows in association with the normal operations, the quicker they're reworked and eroded downstream, you know, the sand's carried away. So in the last experiment, 2004, we saw substantial bar building, but just in the upper part of the system, upper Marble Canyon in the first 40 miles, Lowley's Ferry. And those bars were initially quite stable under fluctuating flows that were what we call shoulder operations, shoulder season operations, relatively low fluctuating flows. During the higher summer and winter fluctuating flows that typically occur throughout the year, those bars were then eroded back. And so over the course of about 18 months to 2 years, a lot of the gains in 04 were returned back to the downstream river. This experiment, again, I think we're looking at a complex response throughout the system. Some sites I'll term winners and others losers, I guess, looking at the photos. And it'll depend on sort of what kind of hydrology we have in the Colorado River system, how much water physically has to be moved from Lake Powell to Lake Mead in the coming year or two, and then the normal operations under the modified low-fluctuating flow alternative, which is the record of decision, will be monitored. So if it gets wetter and the flows tend to be higher under the record of decision, bars tend to erode faster and to a greater extent. If it stays in the drought that we've currently experienced since 2000 and the flows are relatively less in terms of peak discharge, the bars tend to last longer. I think that's the best way we can characterize it in a conceptual way.
Hey, Ted, this is Dave Wagner. Can you tell me how successful the event was to restoring backwaters for the native fish?
You know, Dave, I'm looking at a variety of photos, just a subset of 68 sites that are being physically monitored with repeat measurements, and not seeing what's offshore below the water because I don't have X-ray vision, I can't really say, but it looks to me like about half the sites that I'm looking at in Marble Canyon had a backwater before, and it was either enhanced or remained unchanged by this event. In some cases, there was a backwater, a return current channel habitat that's now gone. So we lost some. That doesn't mean they're lost for good. They could come back again. But as I said, it's a complex response, and it's not simply a matter of all winners or all losers. Some places look better in terms of return current channel habitat, the so-called backwaters. Others look relatively unchanged, and some look like they actually lost habitat that was there in February. So by the time we finish sizing up over 100 of these sites, 68 specifically for backwaters, we'll have a better question or a better answer for you hopefully by next fall.
This is Amanda again at the Associated Press. Could you explain why, you know, at this beach you would have erosion and another beach you would have sandbars built?
Yeah, I'll take that one again. This is Ted. Our basic understanding of how these eddies fill or evacuate with sand really depends on the flow regime as well as the sediment supply upstream. So in a site like this upstream site where you can see that it's eroded or not really gained much, it reflects what we believe is the fact that a lot of the new sand that we've gotten over the previous 18 months before the test was below the site. And so what it was exposed to primarily during the high flow test was clear water releases from the dam with very little new sand to put into the eddy. So the eddy becomes a source of sand to the main stem river rather than a sink for sand from the main stem river into the eddy. So where you have enrichment of sand supplies, eddies tend to fill with new sand downstream of that point. If the new sand supplies are below a certain point, then eddies upstream tend to be scoured and eroded and actually give up the sand that they had before the high flow occurred. It's kind of supply and demand, I guess. You could place it that way.
This is April Reese from Landletter. I had a
couple of questions. One is, how do the results you're seeing now differ from the results you saw during the same period immediately following the test flows in 2004? And also, I was curious, do you feel that, at this point, you've been studying this for a while now, do you think there should be regular high flows? I know that's an argument from environmental groups. It's my understanding the next high flow release isn't scheduled until 2012.
So I'll start with the latter question, and then we'll go back to the technical question from Ted. The timing of doing high flow releases is something that we are studying now, but we're a ways away from being able to tell exactly when and how often you should do these. As Ted was just describing is, if you're not careful about doing these at the right time, you can erode beaches rather than form them. So what we need to decide now is, and what we're looking into, is this time we had 2.7 million tons of sediment to start with, and we're going to try to compare the response with that much sediment to the ones we did previously. And what we'll want to know is, where did it go? As I said before, where did it go and where is it? So that we can find out how much is in the system still. And what we're basically trying to ask a question is, how much do we need? How much sediment do we need that's coming in? As all of you know now, the sediment that comes down the Colorado River is trapped behind that dam. So the only inputs we have are from the tributaries. So we're going to try to estimate what we want, our goal is, how much has to come in from those tributaries, and how does it need to be distributed along the canyon for us to say, okay, now you've reached a time when, if you want to create beaches, this would be a good time to do this. That's going to take us time to know, and I think that's why we can't tell you yet, which is the question I get asked very frequently is, well, when will we do the next one? And the answer to that is still waiting until we figure out exactly what occurred with this one. We don't want to go out quickly and do something that later we'll regret that we made a decision when we did it too fast before we really knew all the answers. And I think, could you repeat your first part of that question, and we'll ask Ted to do that one? If this was the difference between this and the
sure.
last one.
Sure. I'm just curious, you know, how are the results you're seeing now, how do they differ from the results you saw in the same immediate period following the float, the test flows in 2004? Well, I understand there was also an influx of sediment from the Paria River?
Paria River, right. And so the caveat, all that we're saying is, all that we say today with, you know, these are preliminary observations, and we've only even got half the canyon up, but we wanted to get stuff out because we know people are very curious. But I'll let Ted give you his preliminary thoughts.
Okay, so what we saw immediately after the 2004 test was a pretty consistent pattern, I would say, of bar building, sandbar deposition, in the upper part of the upper third of the canyon, if you will. Upper Marble Canyon from about mile 8 or 10 down to about mile 40, sandbars consistently look like they built to a level we hadn't seen them built before, and that was very encouraging. Below mile 40, it looked like a much more mixed response. There were certain winners and losers again. Some bars scoured, and some of those were bars that we hadn't seen scour in 20 years, and other bars built. And it looked like perhaps a process of cannibalization. One loser, and you've got a winner downstream that came at the cost of the loser upstream. In 2004, with about twice as much sand supply going into the test and having it distributed perhaps more uniformly throughout the system rather than mostly high in the system, we're seeing, again, another complex response. It looks encouraging in some reaches, but from the accounts we've seen in the photos and some of the accounts we've heard from our field scientists, it's not a replicate of the 0 through 40 consistent positive response throughout the whole system. There's certainly a reach that looks like their benefits, their gains, but upstream of that reach there were clear losers, and perhaps downstream of that reach it's a mixed response like in 1996 and 2004. And what we're trying to assess right now is where that transition occurs from loss of sites to benefits in terms of bar deposition, and then back to some sort of a transition mixed response with perhaps winners and losers below. But with twice as much sand supply as we had in the 2004 test, we were hoping and expected to see a different response, and I think we're seeing a different response. What we can't say yet is whether it's net beneficial to the system in terms of having more sandbar habitats than we had not only before we started this test, but than we had before we started the 2004 test. These tests were done in two time periods, and the hope was that there would be a cumulative benefit from the first to the second, and it'll take us some time to actually assess whether or not that's actually occurred.
As you probably all guessed, somewhere in that sequence, Ted meant to say 2008, and he said 2004, so the comparison he was giving you was 2004 to 2008.
I have a question. This is Jessica Marshall calling with Discovery Channel News. I'm wondering if there is a particular reason for the sites that were chosen, the Mile 3 site and the Mile 45 site. Is it just upstream and downstream? And can you provide a few more details about the specifics of the ongoing monitoring and evaluation and how you will actually make the determination whether this is a success or not? And just finally, are there any other outcomes that you're looking for aside from improved fish habitat in terms of ecological goals?
So I'll take the second one first, and then we'll do that part. The answer is yes, there are many outcomes that the adaptive management program is looking for, and it's a basic looking at this whole canyon as an ecosystem. And that means that you look at everything from the sand to the water and to the plants and animals that inhabit that environment. So throughout that part, we look at, they'll be looking at vegetation that will grow on these beaches and what kinds of plants and animals come back into that environment. We'll look at endangered species. Humpback chub, as you all know, is one that we're very concerned about, and there's a Kanab amber snail that we look at. We're also, with all the fish, we're going to do a lot of work on what food is available when you do this. What happens when you create these backwaters, and how much food does that create? When you do a high flow test, do you get more food for the plants and animals, or for the animals that live in that environment? So that's the kind of the range of things. We have a science plan that's on our website that you can see that gives you sort of the details of the kinds of things we're studying. So there's a whole slew of kinds of activities that we do that are really defined by the stakeholders. A really important part about this program is that our science is in response to stakeholders' questions. And so that's really an important part of this. We also study archaeological sites. These are sites that are important to the tribes and the Americans who are part of our process. So there's a range of activities that we do defined by this adaptive management program. I'm going to let Ted go back to the first question, which is something about how did we pick the two sites you saw today were just two that we were giving you as a initial thought, ones we could download last night and get out to the web. And I'll tell you how where we have sites and what ones we're monitoring and how we choose them. I'll let Ted do
that. I think what we're showing you in the two sites that you have access to on the website there is that there's a spectrum of responses, some, again, looking very positive and encouraging. Others, at best, I would say maybe that change might be zero. There's another photographic pair that I don't know if you've had access to or not that shows almost the complete evacuation of an existing sandbar at River Mile 6, and that may be available, it may not, but the main message there by showing you two ends of the spectrum is that any of the sites fall somewhere between these two ends, and what makes it difficult for us to say at this early time, whether it was net positive or net negative. I would say, in terms of an experiment, I think it's already a huge success. But in terms of the desired management response outcome, there are just so many sites that fall somewhere in between the two endpoints of that spectrum that it's just impossible at this point to say there was net positive or net negative. And photos kind of give you an idea of what we're dealing with. I mean, when you have a clear winner and a clear loser, if that was the only site of interest, I guess it would be easy to resolve the outcome. But you've got hundreds of sites similar to the ones shown here in the photos, and many of them, if not most of them, fall somewhere in between these two ends. Certainly we didn't have all sites losing sand. Certainly we didn't have all sites gaining sand. And so, again, I use the term complex response, which makes it somewhat frustrating for the managers because they're asked by us to wait a while so we can try to size up sets numerically and from a topographic point of view all the measurements, and that takes some time. But, I think you can visually see some of the sites, like the 45-mile site, where we see an increase in habitat, the return current channel backwater, which is the low velocity habitat. That's what we're hoping to see more of when we tally up all the results. And I just can't say today that we have more habitat than we had beforehand because we haven't done that yet.
We've left Lake Powell Chronicle. I was wondering if you had any kind of estimates on approximately how much sediment was moved by the high flows.
How much was moved downstream to a certain point, or we have an estimate at mile 88 of about 1.0 million tons or so. And that's very preliminary that passed that site, and we believe that we probably had somewhere in the range of 0.5 or 1.7 million tons of new sand upstream of that point. So, again, when we talk about what I'll call the retention efficiency of these things, in trying to build new habitat with new sand, the cost is that you can't avoid moving some of that new sand, and in fact, most of it, unfortunately, moves downstream, and eventually... Without doing high flows like this, we know it'll all move perhaps in a slower manner, but it will eventually move down to Lake Mead and won't really be available for new habitat building. So the high flow experiment is a time of limited duration high flow. The concentrations in sand that are in suspension moving downstream are quite high during that time, but without doing that high flow, there's no way to elevate those new sand grains and deposit them into the eddies. So in this case, initially, it looks like we might have conserved perhaps 15 to 25% of the sand that was through and above mile 88 into either the channel upstream of there or eddies that are adjacent to the channel. And the cost for doing that, of course, was that the majority of that sand passed the point and moved downstream. Now, the downstream reach I'm referring to below mile 88 is also a place that we're trying to assess benefit or loss in. So, just the fact that it moved past mile 88 isn't bad news because, of course, hopefully it went downstream and helped build habitats and sites between mile 88 and 240.
Okay, this is Amanda at the Associated Press again. I was wondering if you could, in more concrete terms, explain the difference of the buildup and the sandbars and then the erosion. Like, you built sandbars as big as X and you eroded as much as Y.
Yes, this is Andrea. Ted's shaking his head, and I think the shaking his head is that's the question that we're working on as we speak. That's really what they're going to try to do. They're out there right now. There's crews out now that are measuring the sizes of each of those beaches and measuring places where it's eroded, and then they'll try to make calculations that will give you how many of those beaches did we create and how big are they, what's the volume of sand in there, so that we can actually get, you know, from the visual pictures you'll see, it's very hard to look at them and say how big they are. I know I was taken aback when I actually looked at them and then stepped on them and walked on them and how much bigger they were than when I first saw them. So I think we're going to have to all have patience and wait for the answer to that one.
I will say a couple of things, Andrea. I think we'd all agree that we can't build sandbars above the water surface when we do these things. I mean, that's sort of the upper limit. And sites where clearly bars were winners and built, we have evidence from the field as well as the photos that the tops of those bars are basically probably within a foot of the maximum water surface, if not right up to the surface. So that's about as good as we can hope to do at a site like that without going to a higher flow or some other mechanism of release. The other thing I've noted, too, in the photos, 1996 bars that built had very steep fronts, and they were commented upon by the users, the recreational users and river guides, as being very hard to sort of get up on top of as camping sites. Bars we saw built in 2004, and the photos of what I'm looking at from 2008 would suggest that the bar faces are much more gradual, and that reflects, I think, the enhanced sand supply over what we had in 96, as well as a couple of changes we made to the hydrograph in terms of how we went up to the peak and then how we came down off of the peak. And hopefully that's of some benefit and use, not only in creating the backwaters, but also to the recreational users who have to find these sites from riverboat trips that they take and moor their boats and then access the site. So bar geometry is important. I think in sites where we saw sandbars built basically up to the high flow water stage level, we couldn't expect anything better than that, obviously, but again, what's troubling is to see sites that maybe didn't gain anything at all or actually lost an existing sandbar. So that's what makes our job difficult as scientists. We have to distill all this information down into a story that's of some use and benefit to the managers in understanding how to apply these high flows if they're done in the future.
Hello, this is Brian Tillman. I'm with the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and I've overseen our restoration efforts. I'm the project leader for the Lower Owens River Project, as well as the Mono Basin Stream Restoration efforts. And one thing I think that's being overlooked in this process here in terms of bar formation that we've seen over and over again in about 10 different regional projects is that vegetation is extremely key to forming bars. And if you time your high flow events at the time that the cottonwoods and willows and other riparian species are at peak seed production, and you start getting that vegetation established down in there, when that vegetation grows up and interacts with those hydraulics, it vortexes those fines and sediments and gravels out. And we see gravels being retained in the system, sediments getting put into bank building, and it's very key to what's going on. And if you have a march flow that's going down, you're just dealing with the rocks and water situation, versus if you start working on establishing vegetation and releasing that water at key times and getting that vegetation in there, you're going to start dropping out sands and sediments and forming bars and holding those bars in the system instead of getting washed downstream on a regular basis. And we've seen that in every single one of our restoration efforts.
Okay, do we have any questions?
Yes. I have a question about the trout. This is Cindy Cole with Arizona Daily Sun. Did trout tagging show that trout were washed pretty far down the river, maybe into the LCR, towards the LCR, or even into the Grand Canyon?
So we have, again, preliminary observations is the way I would categorize this, because we're not quite finished evaluating this data. But so I'll give you just what my recollection is, round numbers that we tagged and that we found. So we put tags on about 90 rainbow trout in the Lees Ferry area, and then we listened for them, I will say, during the high flow event, and we are listening for them as we speak. From the initial results that we get back says that those fish, we've found about 70 of them, and none of those fish, well, to exception of maybe one individual, none of those fish move farther than 0.2 miles from where we released them. So it looks to us initially here that the trout were not washed down from this flow event, that it seems that the trout can stay in the position that they desire at a 41,000 CFS. So, that, of course, it's only 90 fish. There are a lot more than 90 fish out there. We'll use these results to try to see if we can make estimates about the population in general, but it's something I think that may us hopeful that this fishery was not hurt initially by this and may be also improved. We're hoping that food supply, which we'll also be measuring, could have been increased during this time period.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Dave Nemkin with NPCA. A question that I have about the how the analysis and evaluations that you're doing comports with the FONSI and the 5-year steady flow in the fall. Will the adaptive management commitments lend themselves well to adjusting that based upon your findings?
I think you're asking a question for an attorney, not us as a scientist. So
that may well be, but I guess I don't understand with the science. Can that be integrated into the into the adaptive management practices that you're following?
Right. Well, from my understanding from the folks that I talked to in the Department of the Interior, that's their intention, is that we use the adaptive management program and the process, and that if science tells them that this is a direction that is that we know enough about that we can inform that decision, that will be one piece of the decision-making process about when and if you do other high flow events. Well, I think the department is committed to the adaptive management program and will work with adding their science to those programs as appropriate.
Okay. We have more reporters with questions.
Yes, I have another question. This is April Reese again from Land Letter. If it turns out that these experiments aren't successful in reaching and realizing those research goals and ensuring compliance under the Grand Canyon Protection Act, could you eventually get to the point where you need to discuss taking more drastic measures like breaching the dam? And do you think that would be effective?
I think that's that one is clearly outside of my domain. I think that those questions, what I'd suggest for those kinds of questions is to basically go to the department for a response, and that's really outside of a scientist's domain.
Well, it is a scientific question, though, right?
Not really.
Yeah, I don't think so. We're going to answer the question, and we're working on the question. Which we don't have an answer to yet. Is there a flow-only solution to creating and maintaining beaches? And that's the question we're going to be working on. If the answer to that question ends up being no, then it will be up to policymakers to try to decide how best to deal with that problem.
Right, but from a scientific perspective, if you're not able to meet those resource goals, then scientifically speaking, what would you try next?
Well, I think we're getting into two things. Scientifically, we'll study the question of whether you can use flow only. After that, what we usually do is we ask managers to give us ideas that they would do, and that's happened in the past. Managers have given ideas like a bypass tube that would go behind the dam and come around and put sediment back in. Our job would then be, after managers gave us those ideas, then we would evaluate those different options.
Okay, we're going to need to wrap up now. Jennifer is going to have some final information about where you can access some more information. Jennifer?
Jennifer, can I add one thing? I just wanted to make sure that people know, Jennifer will tell you where to go to the website, but that I want to make everyone understand also that we don't do this work in isolation. We couldn't be successful without our colleagues at the Park Service, the Bureau of Reclamation, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and BIA. All these people do this work, not just us at GCMRC and USGS. And without the Adaptive Management Program and the stakeholders' input, we would not be able to do our work.
Okay, there's a couple of resources I'd like to share with you guys. You can go to our homepage at usgs.gov and either click on our science feature on the high flow or the newsroom tab. That'll give you access to time-lapse videos as well as a video podcast. And if you go to our podcast page and click on links, you can get access to high-resolution images that you can feel free to use. Also, the recording of today's conference call will be placed on our media advisory tomorrow. If any of you guys would like broadcast quality video, you can contact Don Becker at 605-594-6175, and he'd be happy to get you that video as quickly as possible. And more information on the high flow experiment, you can find it at ccmrc.gov.
Thank you all.